You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 25th, 2024. I'm Brecken from Drake University. Here's our first story. This article is titled Iowan's History Project Helped Shine Light on Unrecognized Heroes, and it's by Jamie Stengel. There is a photograph that is attached to this article, and the caption says, This photo provided by the Ghost Army Legacy Project shows a Jeep getting a new bumper markings for special effects. For decades, their mission during World War II was a secret, with inflatable tanks, trucks, and planes, combined with sound effects, radio trickery, costume uniforms and acting, the American military units that became known as the Ghost Army helped out with the enemy. Their efforts were recognized with the Congressional Gold Medal on March 21st. And the photo is a black and white photo. It's in the winter, and there are three men marking up a car. It's an older, like, beat-up Jeep, but they're hard at work doing that. All right, we'll get into the article now. With inflatable tanks, radio trickery, costume uniforms, and acting, the American military units that became known as the Ghost Army outwitted the enemy during World War II. Their mission was kept secret for decades, but last week, the group stepped out of the shadows as they were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal at a ceremony in Washington. The actions of the Ghost Army helped change the course of the war for thousands of Americans and Allied troops and contributed to the liberation of a continent from a terrible evil, Secretary of Army Christine Wormuth said during the ceremony at the U.S. Capitol. She said many of the techniques the Ghost Army pioneered are still used on the battlefield. Even though our technology has changed quite a bit since 1944, our modern techniques build on a lot of what the Ghost Army did, and we are still learning from your legacy, she said. Three of the seven known surviving members attended the ceremony at the U.S. Capitol. Bernard Bluestein, 100, of Hoffman Estates, Illinois, John Christman, 99, of Leesburg, New Jersey, and Seymour Nussenbaum, 100, of Monroe Township, New Jersey. Nussenbaum, who grew up in New York City, was studying art at the Pratt Institute before he joined the Army. Eventually, he joined a unit specializing in camouflage that was part of the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops. Our mission was to fool the enemy, to put on a big act, said Nussenbaum, a painter who went on to into a career of commercial art. It was like putting on a big production, he said in an interview before the ceremony. We have had, in some cases, people impersonating generals, putting on a general's uniform and walking around the streets, he said. Senator Edward Markey of Massachusetts said during the ceremony that the Ghost Army members were creative, original thinkers who used engineering, art, architecture, and advertising to wage a battle with the enemy. Their weapons were unconventional, but their patriotism was unquestionable, he said. House Speaker Mike Johnson from Louisiana said during the ceremony that an estimated 15,000 to 30,000 lives were saved because of the Ghost Army's work. The legislation to honor the military units with the Congressional Gold Medal, Congress's highest honor, was signed into law by President Joe Biden in 2022. That came after almost a decade of work by family members of the soldiers and Rick Byers, a filmmaker and author who helped bring their story to light after their mission was declassified in 1996. Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa celebrated the grassroots efforts of Caleb Sinwell of Nashua, Iowa, who won first place for his National History Day project researching the Ghost Army. Grassley was a co-sponsor of the Ghost Army Congressional Gold Medal Act. While the valiant efforts of the Ghost Army were kept secret for over 50 years, today, these brave veterans finally received the recognition they deserve, Grassley said in a news release. I give great credit to Caleb's personal passion and hard work. I appreciate his love for history. Caleb's efforts show how one person can make a difference. National History Day Executive Director Kathy Gorn said in the release, the project is a perfect example of why the extracurricular program matters. NHD empowers students to choose a project topic they care about, explore primary sources from the selected time period, and create a project that lives beyond the classroom. Gorn said, NHD is proud to have Caleb in his advocacy, and Iowa is lucky to have him representing the state at these national events. Byer, the president of the Ghost Army Legacy Project, produced and directed the 2013 documentary, The Ghost Army, and co-authored the 2015 book, The Ghost Army of World War II. They put themselves in harm's way, wielding imagination, bravado, and creativity in order that the other soldiers might be able to fight and live, Beyer told those gathered Thursday. This is a day that has been a long time coming, but has been well worth the wait, he said. The Ghost Army included about 1,100 soldiers in the 23rd Headquartered Special Troops, which carried out about 20 battlefield deceptions in France, Luxembourg, Belgium, and Germany, and around 200 soldiers in the 3,133rd Signal Company Special, which carried out two deceptions in Italy. One of the biggest missions, called Operation Viersen, came in March 1945, when the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops' deception drew German units away from the point on the Rhine River where the 9th Army was crossing. They had hundreds of inflatables set up, Beyer said in an interview before the ceremony. They had their sound trucks operating for multiple nights. They had other units attached to them. They had set up multiple phony headquarters and staffed them with officers who were pretending to be colonels. This was an all-hands-on-deck affair, and it was completely successful, Beyer said. It fooled the Germans. They moved their troops to the river opposite of where the deception was. In September 1944, the Ghost Army helped fill a gap in General George Patton's line during an attack on the Germans in the French city of Metz. Scott Stewart of the Nonpareil contributed to this report. There's also a picture associated with the article, and in the background you can see Senator Grassley, as well as some other representatives, and both, there's two of the members of the Ghost Army, Seymour Nussenbaum, and Bernard Bloomstein, and they are both looking, they're all dressed up very nicely, and in the photograph, House Speaker Mike Johnson is presenting the Congressional Award to Bernard, and they're looking quite excited to be there, and everybody looks to be happy. Next, we have training series for RAGBRAI planned. Registration is open for the Iowa Bicycle Coalition's ride series to help Iowa cyclists prepare for the RAGBRAI. The Pigtails Ride, Bakoon Ride, and Big Rove Ride are all hosted by the Coalition on some of Iowa's favorite trails in May and June, according to the news release. The family-friendly events include food, drinks, and fun for the entire biking community. We're incredibly proud to host these rides and give cyclists the opportunity to spend their summer training with the bicycling community, Iowa Bicycle Coalition Executive Director Luke Hoffman said in the release. Pigtails Ride, a woman-specific 48-mile bike ride, will be Saturday, May 18th, and covers Ankeny's Prairie Trail and the High Trestle Trail. Bakoon Ride, a 71-mile ride of the Raccoon River Valley Trail, will be Saturday, June 15th, and features bacon treats along the way. Big Rove Ride, a 36-mile ride on Saturday, June 29th, has dual start at the Big Grove Brewery in Iowa City and Cedar Rapids. It cruises along the Iowa River Corridor Trail, including a stop at the brewery's local in Solon. Ticket prices will increase on April 1st. You can register at iowabicyclecoalition.org. This year's RAGBRAI will kick off in Glenwood. The first leg, Glenwood to Red Oak, is Sunday, July 21st. RAGBRAI will be here before you know it. Weather this spring has given us plenty of opportunities to get out and ride, RAGBRAI Ride Director Matt Pipson said in the release. Support the Iowa Bicycle Coalition and use these events to train. We want the best version of you riding your bike with us in July. Next, we have History Group Invites Public Preservation Celebration at Library this Saturday by Tim Rower. Council Bluffs has several groups devoted to historic preservation, working to keep the community's history intact and celebrate its legacy. On Saturday, the public can learn more about the organizations during the Historic Preservation Celebration at the Council Bluffs Public Library. The whole point is to help inform the public about what historic preservation is and how these different groups contribute to historic preservation, said Troy Stolp, a devoted supporter of preserving the rich history of this area. Stolp is not only a board member on Preserve Council Bluffs, but also a commissioner on the Council Bluffs Historic Preservation Commission, and the main person putting together this first ever event involving the city's historical preservation organizations. Between 9 and 11 groups are expected to attend, Stolp said. Among the others are Pottawatomie County Historical Society, Union Pacific, and various neighborhood associations. Hopefully we can inform the public and get them involved, Stolp said. Representatives will have tables so community members can meet the groups, and there will be a 30-minute in-depth presentations followed by a question-answer session. The event, which runs from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., will also be a chance for business owners to get advice on regulations for preserving historic buildings, Stolp said. We want to make it easier for them, he said. It is a much easier process than what people think. That seems like it's going to be a really great event for all of those history buffs out there. So that's very exciting. Next, we have Abortion Rights Backed Big Among Group. Nearly 8 in 10 AAPI adults in U.S. think abortion should be legal. This is by Graham Lee Brewer and Amelia Thompson DeVoe. With abortion rights poised to be one of the major issues in the 2024 election, a new poll shows that Asian Americans, Native Hawaiians, and Pacific Islanders in the United States are highly supportive of legal abortion, even in situations where the pregnant person wants an abortion for any reason. The poll from AAPI Data and the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research finds that nearly 8 in 10 Asian Americans, Native Hawaiians, and Pacific Islanders think abortion should be legal in all or most cases. They're also supportive of federal government action to preserve abortion rights. 3/4 of AAPI adults say Congress should pass a law guaranteeing access to legal abortions nationwide. By comparison, an AP NORC poll conducted in June found that 64% of U.S. adults think abortion should be legal in all or most cases, and 6 in 10 adults overall say Congress should pass a law guaranteeing access. AAPI adults are more likely than Americans overall to identify as Democrats, which may partially explain why their levels of support for legal abortion are higher than among the general population. But even among Democrats, AAPI adults are more supportive of legal abortion later in pregnancy. AAPI Democrats are especially likely to support legal abortion without any limits. More than half of this group say abortion should be legal in all cases, compared to 40% of Democrats overall. AAPI Republicans are also more likely than Republicans to support a law guaranteeing access to legal abortions nationwide. More than half, 57%, of AAPI Republicans think abortions should be legal in at least some cases, compared to 38% of Republicans in general. About half, 51%, of AAPI Republicans also think Congress should pass a law guaranteeing access to legal abortion nationwide, while only 32% of Republicans overall want this to happen. Although AAPI voters are a fast-growing demographic with a particularly large presence in states like California, Texas, and New York, their attitudes can often not be analyzed in other surveys because of small survey sample sizes, among other issues. This survey is part of an ongoing project focusing on AAP Americans' views. High turnout in areas with large AAPI communities could help Democrats in competitive House districts, and a broader conversation about whether non-white voters are shifting to the right may lead to more courting of AAPI voters. The survey's findings suggest that abortion could be a strong issue for Democratic candidates who are looking to reach AAPI communities and a challenge for Republicans. It saddens me how politics got involved in this, and they really shouldn't have been, said Deborah Nanez, a 72-year-old retired nurse in Tucson, Arizona, and an independent voter. Nanez identifies as Asian, Native American, and Hispanic. It's a woman's body. How can you tell us what we can do with our bodies, what we can keep, and what we cannot keep? It's ridiculous. While an AP NORC poll conducted in October 2022, found that more than 4 in 10 Americans overall trust Democrats to do a better job of handling the issue of abortion, while only 2 in 10 have more trust in Republicans. The poll released Thursday says that the trust gap between the party is far wider for AAPI adults. 55% of AAPI adults trust Democrats on abortion policy, while only 12% trust Republicans. More than half of AAPI adults were born outside the U.S., according to the survey. For many of those immigrants and their first-generation American children, abortion isn't viewed as just health care. It can also be seen as a right that was not afforded to them in their countries of origin, said Varun Naikor, executive director of AAPI Victory Alliance, a progressive political advocacy organization. I think it has to do with some sort of home country attitudes that are sort of pervasive, but also the strong feeling we've had rights and we've had access to healthcare, and now we don't want to lose something that we had, and it could be that we also came to this country to have better access to healthcare than we did before, NICOR said. Nearly 6 in 10 AAPI adults don't want Congress to pass a law preserving states' ability to set their own laws allowing or restricting abortion, and only 14% support the passage of a law banning access to abortions nationwide. Joey Meyer, 24, is a healthcare consultant in Florida, where abortions are prohibited after 15 weeks of pregnancy. She said that given that other nearby states like Alabama and Georgia have even more restrictive abortion laws, she would have to travel far to receive the procedure. I'm 24, and maybe some people my age are having children, but if I were to get in that position to be pregnant, I don't think I would feel ready, she said. So that would be something I would have to think about. Meyer, who was born in China but has lived in the U.S. since an infant, has made plans with a friend in California in case she does ever need an abortion. Even if there's a closer state, would I want to do that alone and have to really navigate that physical and emotional pain alone? Not really, Meyer said. We're now going to move on to some more nation and world news. This article is Suspects Appear in Court, Nation Observes Day of Mourning for Victims of Concert Hall Attack. And this is coming from the Associated Press. Three of the four suspects charged with carrying out the concert hall attack in Moscow that killed more than 130 people admitted guilt for the incident in a Russian court Sunday. Moscow's Basmany District Court formally charged Dalarzon Mirzoyev, 32, Sadikrami Rachabalizoda, 30, Mukhammad Subir Faizov, 19, and Shamsuddin Feriduni, 25. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing those names correctly, but I did my best phonetically. with committing a group terrorist attack resulting in the death of others. This offense carries a maximum sentence of life imprisonment. The court ordered that the men, all Tajikistan citizens, be held in pretrial custody until May 2022. Mirzoyev, Rachabalizoda, and Shamsuddin Feriduni all admitted guilt after being charged. The fourth, Fazoev, was brought to court directly from a hospital in a wheelchair and sat with his eyes closed throughout the proceedings. He wore a hospital gown and trousers and was seen with multiple cuts, and he was attended by medics. The other three suspects appeared in court heavily bruised with swollen faces, amid reports in Russian media that they were tortured during interrogation by the security services. One suspect, Sadikrami Rachabalizoda, had a heavily bandaged ear. Russian media reported Saturday that one of the suspects had his ear cut off during interrogation. The Associated Press could not verify the report or videos which purported to show this. The hearing came as Russia observed a national day of mourning following the attack on Friday on the suburban Crocus City Hall concert venue that killed at least 137 people. 182 were reported injured. Events at cultural institutions were canceled, flags were lowered to half-staff, and television entertainment and advertising were suspended, according to state news agency RIA Novosti. A steady stream of people added to a makeshift memorial near the burnt-out concert hall, creating a huge mound of flowers. As rescuers continue to search the damaged building and the death toll rises as more bodies are found, some families still don't know if relatives who went to the event targeted by gunmen on Friday are alive. Moscow's Department of Health said Sunday it began identifying the bodies of those killed via DNA testing, which will take at least 2 weeks. Russian authorities arrested the four attack suspects Saturday, with seven more detained on suspicion of involvement, Russian President Vladimir Putin said during an address to the nation Saturday night. He claimed that they were captured while fleeing to Ukraine, something Kyiv firmly denies. The attack, which has been claimed by an affiliate of the Islamic State group, is the deadliest on Russian soil in years. U.S. intelligence officials said they have confirmed the IS affiliate's claim. Meanwhile, Poland demanded an explanation from Russia on Sunday after one of its missiles strayed briefly into Polish airspace during a major missile attack on Ukraine, prompting the NATO member to activate F-16 fighter jets. Next, we have the New England cleans up after major snowstorm. New England spent Sunday shoveling out after a major storm dumped more than 2 feet of snow in some areas, leaving hundreds of thousands across the Northeast without electricity. The combination of sleet, Freezing rain and heavy wet snow was blamed for hundreds of delayed and canceled flights. Zach Tyler, a meteorologist for the National Weather Service, said heavy snowfall from the storm stretched across the region, including New York through Vermont, New Hampshire, and most of Maine. He said another significant winter storm is developing in the west and will continue through Monday across much of the Rockies, the Plains, and the upper Midwest. Police across the Northeast reported hundreds of traffic accidents due to icy roads, while Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Boston also saw heavy rain and flooding. Goodness, I wish that the weather would choose to either be winter or spring so we could stop worrying about all this snow, but evidently that's not the case. Next, we have some information on gardening. It's the year of the buddleia. The National Garden Bureau has selected several plants under its Year of Program. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote about the Year of the Angelonia, the group's chosen annual, and it's chosen for the shrub designatee. The National Garden Bureau has gone where few have dared to tread, the Year of the Buddleia. No plant brings as much joy to the garden as the buddleia or butterfly bush. If you hate bees, butterflies, and hummingbirds, then this is not the plant for you. But the real angst comes from the fact that in some locales and regions, the buddleia has been designated as invasive. As I travel the South, I am always asking gardeners and industry and university horticulture specialists if they have seen one come up, or one that has escaped. So far, the answer is no. The National Garden Bureau has done a great job of explaining the latest efforts in breeding and the successes it has found in creating new varieties that can be planted without fear of contributing to the latest version of a kudzu. The Bureau also took a look at buddleia, and buddleja, the famous Adam Buddle, an 18th century botanist. The most enlightening thing I read was that the butterfly bush has the nickname of bombastic bush. The buddleia actually has a history as a symbol of the resurrection, rebirth, and new beginnings, as this bombastic bush would somehow spring up from war-torn rubble in Europe, offering communities a sign of hope. I can just imagine the elation of a beautiful blooming shrub springing up out of the debris, offering a tantalizing fragrance and accompanied by the feeding of butterflies and hummingbirds. It's about this time someone will tell me you have to have a larval host plant. There are acres of wilderness behind my backyard, and yes, I plant larval host plants in my landscape. But for the short life cycle they have getting nectar, I want them all in my yard. I want to be all I can be feeding them, but the butterfly bush will also play a vital role. To me, Miss Molly is the most beautiful butterfly bush on the planet. I've got two and would like at least two more. I've just pruned mine and look for them to be under 6 feet by the end of season. Proven Winners calls the color ruby red pink, and I'll toss in magenta as another descriptor. It is certified as non-invasive, as are Miss Violet and Miss Ruby. This non-invasive certification allows them to be shipped to Oregon and Washington, though under the name Summer Lilacs. The Lo and Behold series are as beautiful as the Miss series, but shorter. They are in the 24 to 30 inch range with an equal spread. Of the six colors, five have the non-invasive certification. The Pugsor series has become the all-star of the butterfly bush world. Recently, I wrote about how Pugsor amethyst was chosen as the 2024 Flower of the Year. It was already a winner in Europe, and every gardener who tries it falls madly in love with it, including the garden guy. Pugsor buddleias are shorter, with more fragrant full-size flowers. I've used them in shorter companions with Limelight Prime hydrangeas. There are five colors in the Pugsor group, and all will steal your heart. Buddleias require fertile, well-drained soil with plenty of sunlight. A boggy, soggy soil will simply not work. An annual pruning or cutting back hard is vital to the structure of your plant. Hats off to the National Garden Bureau for making 2024 the Year of the Buddleia. Next, we have Christians mark Palm Sunday. Pope decides to skip homily at last minute amid health problems. Thousands of Christian faithfuls attended Palm Sunday celebrations at the Jerusalem's Sacred Mount of Olives, marking the first day of the Holy Week as conflict surges across the region. Pilgrims waved branches and fronds in the air, items that were placed before Jesus' feet as he was greeted by cheering crowds during his entrance into Jerusalem, according to the Bible. Earlier Sunday, Jerusalem's Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and that's spelled Sepulchre, so I know that I incorrectly pronounced that, but that's revered as the site of Jesus' crucifixion, also held a service. The annual celebration came as the Israel-Hamas war rages on in Gaza, and as Israel has seen a huge downturn in tourism. The war began October 7th when Hamas militants from Gaza invaded southern Israel, killing 1,200 people and taking 250 others hostage. Israel responded with an air and ground war that has left more than 32,000 Palestinians dead, according to the health ministry in the Hamas-ruled territory. However, the conflict appeared to have little effect on the procession, which swelled to a similar size as last year. Although there is war, in my impression, I don't feel any kind of tension, said David Menani, a pilgrim from Italy. The celebration marks the beginning of the most somber week in the Christian calendar, which marks Jesus' crucifixion on Good Friday and his resurrection on Easter. I'm here because I love Jesus Christ, said Jennifer Whedon, who traveled from the United States for the occasion. In Rome, Pope Francis decided at the last minute to skip his homily during Palm Sunday Mass in St. Peter's Square, avoiding a strenuous speech at the start of a busy Holy Week that will test his increasingly frail health. Hobbled by bad knees and persistent respiratory problems, Francis also didn't participate in the procession of cardinals around the obelisk in the piazza at the start of the Mass. Instead, the 87-year-old Catholic pontiff blessed the palm fronds and olive branches from the altar. Francis was expected to deliver a homily halfway through the service, and a prepared text had been distributed to journalists. However, when an aide presented Francis with his glasses to begin reading, the Pope made clear he wouldn't deliver the remarks, leaving the crowd waiting in silence. Vatican officials didn't immediately explain why. The Vatican press office later said the homily was replaced by a moment of silence and prayer. Francis did pronounce prayers throughout the service and offered a long appeal for peace at the end of the Mass. He said he was praying for the families of those killed in what he calls an inhumane attack at a suburban Moscow concert hall, and also asked for prayers for the martyred Ukraine and people of Gaza. Vatican officials estimated some 60,000 people attended the Mass, held under a sunny, breezy spring sky. Francis spent several minutes greeting them from the Pope Mobile, making several loops around the piazza at the end of the service. Francis has been battling on and off all winter what he and the Vatican have described as a case of the flu, bronchitis, or cold. And then there is an image that is included with this article. The description states, Pope Francis, far left, celebrates Mass on Palm Sunday in St. Peter's Square at the Vatican. He is sitting on a chair, and there are other, I would assume, clergymen who are holding fronds in front of him. They all have their back turned to the camera, so the only person facing forward is the Pope. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, March 25th, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled in Des Moines. I'm Brecken from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this, or any other IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Next, we have Israeli assaults continue in near Gaza hospitals. UN Palestinian aid group says its food convoys are blocked. Palestinians who fled an ongoing Israeli raid of Gaza's main hospital described mass arrests and forced marches past bodies in interviews on Sunday. While the United Nations says Israel is now blocking its main agency, helping Palestinians from sending food aid to the enclave's destroyed, devastated north. Israel's military says it killed more than 170 militants and detained about 480 suspects in the raid on Shifa Hospital that began last Monday, calling it a blow to Hamas and other militants it says regrouped there whereas the war nears the six-month mark. Israel's military accuses Hamas of using hospitals as shields. Israeli jets on Sunday launched strikes near Shifa Hospital, which largely stopped functioning following a November raid. Israel's military early Sunday also stormed two hospitals in the city of Khan Yunis amid very intense shelling, the Palestinian Red Crescent Society said. Hardly any aid has been delivered in recent weeks to northern Gaza in Gaza City, where Shifa is located. The area suffered widespread devastation early in Israel's offense after the October 7th Hamas attack that triggered the war. As of Sunday, Israel told the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees it will no longer approve agency food convoys to northern Gaza, UNRWA Chief Philippe Lazzarini said on social media. The US, Qatar, and Egypt are trying to broker another ceasefire and release of Hamas-held hostages. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said he was traveling to the U.S. on Sunday at Washington's invitation. Next, for Women's History Month, there is an article about horticulture trailblazers, women who made a lasting impact on American gardening, and this is by Jessica Damiano. Women have long been at the forefront of gardening, whether passing agricultural traditions from generation to generation, organizing garden clubs and beautification societies, or in some cases making significant contributions to science and landscape design. Some of these plants women gain notoriety for their work. Many are not well known. Here are several who left permanent marks on American horticulture history. First, we have Jane Colden. In the 1750s, Colden became the first female American botanist. She was credited with naming and cataloging hundreds of native plants in the Hudson River Valley using Swedish botanist Carolus Linnaeus's then new binomial structure of botanical nomenclature. Colden was the first in America to employ the system, which assigns a genus and species to each plant. She was also the first to describe and name the gardenia. Colden drew each of the plants she named and compiled her detailed descriptions and illustrations into a manuscript titled The Flora of New York. Then there's Beatrix Ferrand. Known as the First Lady of American Landscape Architecture, Ferrand designed more than 100 gardens for private estates, public parks, college campuses, botanical gardens, and even the White House's East Garden during the Wilson presidency. In 1899, at the age of 27, the self-taught Ferrand became the only woman among the founders of the American Society of Landscape Architects. And in 1912, when the field was still dominated by men, she was hired by Princeton University as the first consulting landscape architect, a position she held for 31 years. Next, we have Fannie Lou Hamer. A civil rights and agricultural activist, Hamer founded the Freedom Farm Cooperative in the late 1960s to provide land, livestock, and vegetable growing resources to poor black families and farmers in Sunflower County, Mississippi. The cooperative facilitated crop sharing, self-reliance, and financial independence. Participating families were also loaned a piglet to help raise to maturity, after which they would return it for mating and give the cooperative two piglets from each litter to continue the programming. If you have a pig in your backyard, if you have some vegetables in your garden, you can feed yourself and your family and no one can push you around, Hamer said. Her cooperative became one of the earliest examples of modern community gardening and a precursor of today's food justice movement. Next, we have Claudia, quote-unquote Ladybird Johnson. First Lady from 1963 to 1969, Johnson was an environmentalist and early native plants proponent who advocated for preserving wild spaces. She led the effort to secure the passage of the 1965 Highway Beautification Act during her husband's presidency. The law sought to clear highways of billboards and to plant wildflowers along the shoulders to support plant and animal biodiversity and regional identity. Today, the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center at the University of Texas at Austin honors her legacy. Next, we have Carrie Lippincott. To contribute to her family's income, Lippincott of Minneapolis started a seed business in 1886. Calling herself the Pioneer Seedswoman of America, she published the first seed catalog explicitly targeted to women, featuring a conversational introduction and illustrations of women, children, and flowers at a time when other catalogs were simply text on paper. The pamphlet also was the first to specify the number of seeds included in each packet. The style and format revolutionized how seeds were sold, and they were soon emulated by competing seed companies. Business bloomed, and soon Miss C.H. Lippincott Flower Seeds was shipping seeds worldwide. Next, we have Mary Clark Taylor. In 1941, Taylor became the first black woman to receive a doctorate in botany in the United States and the first woman of any race to gain a PhD in science from Fordham University. As an educator, she applied her doctoral research on the effect of light on plant growth to change the way high school science was taught. She encouraged the use of light microscopes and botanical materials in the classroom for the first time. In the mid-1960s, President Lyndon B. Johnson enlisted her to expand her teaching methods nationwide. Taylor also served as chair of Howard University's botany department for nearly 30 years until her retirement in 1976. Next, we have Wahine. Also known as Buffalo Bird Woman, Wahine was a Haidatsa woman born around 1839 in what is now North Dakota. She mastered and shared centuries-old cultivating, planting, and harvesting techniques with Gilbert L. Wilson, a minister and anthropologist who studied the tribe in the early 1900s. During visits that spanned 10 years, Wilson, whose work was sponsored by the American Museum of Natural History, transcribed Wahine's words with her son serving as an interpreter. The resulting book, Buffalo Bird Woman's Garden, Agriculture of the Haidatsa Indians, first published in 1917, documented the Haidatsa woman's methods for growing beans, corn, squash, sunflowers, and tobacco, as well as the tools they used and their practices for drying and winter storages. Her advice is still relevant today. We are now going to move into some sports articles. Caps honor Oshie for playing 1,000 games. TJ Oshie returned to the Capitals lineup Sunday, getting back just in time for the ceremony honoring his milestone of playing in 1,000 NHL games, and more importantly, at a crucial juncture of the season, with his team trying to desperately to make the playoffs. Oshie was back after missing the past two games. The 37-year-old winger has been out, off, and on in recent months while dealing with nagging back problems that have threatened to derail his career. With Tom Wilson serving a 6-game suspension, the Capitals could use Oshie down the stretch. Their next game against Detroit on Tuesday is pivotal in the Eastern Conference playoff race. I find even of late, we're missing a little bit of his poise with the puck, his veteran presence on the ice when things get a little bit scrambly, Washington coach Spencer Carberry said Sunday. He can calm things down because he can find a way out of a situation with a lot of poise and calmness. He handles those situations as good as anybody I've been around with his boys. Capital players wore number 77 jerseys during pregame warmups that will be autographed and auctioned, with proceeds going to the Alzheimer's Drug Discovery Foundation. Oshie's dad died of the disease. Next, we have Blazers heading to historic loss season. Portland Trail Blazers coach Chauncey Billups said recently that he fully expects several injured players to play again this season and that shutting down players is not in the team's plans. I think we have so much growth and development that needs to happen, Billups said. Obviously, we know we're not going to the playoffs, but these dudes need to get better. They need to get to know each other while playing. The only way you get better at basketball is playing basketball. Bringing key players back this late in the season would be a departure from how the franchise operated near the end of the last two seasons, when the Blazers blatantly sat key players in order to accumulate as many losses as possible. More losses means a better shot at landing a high draft pick through the league's lottery process. However, stacking losses this time around could result in the Blazers producing one of the four worst seasons in the franchise's 54-season existence. The Blazers hit the 60-loss mark just three times in its prior 53 seasons. To avoid the fourth such season could require having nearly all hands on deck for the remainder of the season. Another little brief update about a suspension. Utah's Chris Dunn was suspended 2 games, and Houston's Jabari Smith Jr. was banned at a game Sunday by the NBA after their fight on Saturday. The two were away from the ball when they began grabbing and shoving each other with 11 minutes and 55 seconds remaining in the second quarter of the Rockets' 147-119 win in Houston. For any NASCAR friends, we have an article titled Byron Slams Door on Final Lap. Hendrick's driver dominates first road course race of the season. This is by Jim Vertuno. William Byron won the Daytona 500 with an agonizing final lap under a caution flag. He took the checkered flag on Sunday at the Circuit of Americas at full throttle. Byron started from pole position and delivered a dominant drive in NASCAR's first road course race of the season. The Hendrick Motorsports driver led 48 of 68 laps and built the big lead he needed to hold off a hard-charging run from Joe Gibbs Racing's Christopher Bell over the last two laps. Bell shaved nearly 3 seconds off Byron's lead to create some late drama before Byron slammed the door over the final corners. "I was trying not to make mistakes," Byron said. "I knew that last lap he was going to be pushing hard." Even when he was building the lead, Byron said he knew that the victory would be tight at the end. "Everyone is too good, and that car was too close," Byron said. A self-taught racer who used computer equipment to hone his skills, Byron earned career win number 12 and his second on a road course. The Circuit of the Americas, a track built for Formula One, has been the first road course for NASCAR each of the last four seasons. And unlike the crash-filled triple overtime race of 2023, Sunday's race was mostly incident-free as Byron made easy work of the field. Byron led 23 laps of the first two stages, but quickly dropped to the third at the start of the final stage as Ross Chastain, who won the COTA in 2022, jumped to the front. Byron fought back to pass him with 25 laps to go, and both cars pitted on the same lap. Chastain then got hung up in traffic on the re-entry and fell several cars behind. That gave Byron the chance to open up the gap that he needed. And there's a couple of pictures that go with this article. The first one shows all of the races in the middle of the first turn of the race. So they're all turning. And this took place in Austin, Texas. So you can see in the background the stadium called Echo Park. And there's tons of people sitting in the stands. And the cars are off. Then there's also a second picture. And it is showing William Byron celebrating his win. He's standing on the window of his like bright yellow race car, and he's got his hands in the air. There's confetti in the air falling all around him, and he's smiling, presumably due to his win. Next, we have Van Dogs, Yale Borrows Idaho's Band. All right, I'm reading this first sentence, and I'm not sure what how long ago, but it just says this past. The University of Idaho Marching Band adopted a new name. It's not the Vandal Marching Band, it's the Van Dogs Marching Band, after becoming the adopted band for the Yale basketball team during its runoff in the NCAA tournament. Yale's band was unavailable to join its team in the Pacific Northwest for the first weekend of the NCAA tournament because it's on spring break on campus and pulling together a traveling group wasn't possible. But the school found some willing stand-ins in the form of the Idaho Band, which quickly became a viral sensation on social media following 13th-seeded Yale's upset victory against number 4 seed Auburn on Friday. "We want to help out another university. We want to help out another band," said Spencer Martin, the director of the athletic bands at Idaho. The Vandal Marching Band, or Van Dogs, as they're jokingly calling themselves this weekend, wore t-shirts provided by Yale. They learned Bulldog, the Yale fight song, and performed it 5 or 6 times during the win over Auburn, despite not practicing it as a group until 9 a.m. local time Friday morning when the musicians gathered inside Idaho's Kibbe Dome for practice. Yale would have brought its band if not for being at the end of its 2-week spring break. Yale was also without its band last week at the Ivy League tournament. But the Vandals were willing to help, especially with Idaho serving as the host school for the tournament site. Yale is covering the expenses for the Vandals to make the 85-mile trip from campus in Moscow. "We wanted to do a good job, and I think it sounded pretty good," Martin said. "It certainly got stuck in our heads." Martin said the first call about the possibility was made on Sunday night, and the process for pulling together a group to perform started quickly. Idaho's band had not completely unpacked its gear from traveling to the Big Sky Conference tournament in Boise, Idaho last week, so that was all ready to go. It also became a chance for musicians who weren't part of the group that traveled to the conference to get a tournament to perform in the postseason. A whole bunch of younger students got to go and do this with Yale. This was not our most advanced band, Martin said. "We had a lot of youth, which was really cool, so it was neat to be able to give those students that experience." There's a picture that's associated, and it is of a college-age student standing in the middle of a audience for a game. I believe it was the Yale-Auburn game that this photo is from, but he's wearing a Yale sweatshirt. And it states, a Yale fan cheers during the second half of an NCAA tournament first round game between Bulldogs and Auburn on Friday in Spokane, Washington. We now have some more notes about some college basketball. May leaves FAU, takes over at Michigan. The lure of Michigan became apparent to Dusty May not in the last few days, but almost 20 years ago when he was just starting his coaching career. He was an assistant at Eastern Michigan and then quickly realized Michigan's logo, the famed block M, was something that people took enormous pride in being associated with. And when Michigan offered him a chance to wear it, he couldn't say no. May was announced as the new coach at Michigan on Sunday, agreeing to a 5-year deal worth almost $19 million. He leaves Florida Atlantic after 6 seasons, highlighted by a Final Four run a year ago, and more wins in the last 2 years than almost anyone nationally. This place allowed me to be extremely selective, to take the job that was the perfect fit, May told the Associated Press. I would never feel any remorse if I were at FAU forever. I almost wanted these other jobs to go away, to get filled, so I wouldn't have to make a decision. The deal with Michigan was done Saturday night, one day after FAU lost to Northwestern in the NCAA tournament. May brought players at his now former school in for a series of team and individual meetings on Sunday morning, saying afterwards those talks were extremely tough. And in a little bit more close to home, DeVries leaves Drake for West Virginia job. West Virginia has tapped Drake men's basketball coach Darian DeVries to move to the Mountaineers past one of the ugliest years in school history. West Virginia athletic director Ren Baker said DeVries signed a 5-year contract. DeVries' hiring comes 3 days after Drake bowed out of the NCAA tournament with a first-round loss to Washington State. The 48-year-old player has a 150-55 record in 6 seasons with Drake, taking them to the NCAA tourney 3 times. Next, we have Edey, Purdue take down Utah State, roll into Sweet 16. For Zach Edey and Purdue, it was just another step toward a goal. A dominant performance, but just another step regardless. They want more. There's no satisfaction, Edey said. I didn't come back to make the Sweet 16. I came back to make a run, a deep run. So far, so good. Edey had 23 points and 14 rebounds, and the top-seeded Boilermakers advanced to the second weekend of the NCAA tournament by pounding 8th-seeded Utah State 106-67 on Sunday. Trey Kaufman-Wren added 18 points with 8 boards for Purdue, 31-7, which broke the school's single-season record for victories. Purdue playing out of the Midwest region also set a school record for most points in a March Madness game. Edey, meanwhile, became the first player since Lou Alcindor in 1968 with at least 50 points, 35 rebounds, and a field goal percentage of 65% through 2 rounds of the NCAA tourney. Nobody is satisfied with where we are now, Edey said. Fletcher Lawyer had 15 points, and Braden Smith had all of his 6 assists in the second half when the Boilermakers shot 62.5% from the field before pulling the starters. Great Osabor, the Mountain West Player of the Year, had 14 points and 6 rebounds for Utah State. The Aggies, 28-7, were out-rebounded 49-26, and they headed home still in search of the program's first regional semifinal since 1970. Golden Eagles survived Buff's dynamic offense. Marquette showed resolve in critical moments and avoided another early exit from March Madness. Tyler Kolek had 21 points and 11 assists, and David Joplin made 2 free throws with 7.4 seconds left to help the Golden Eagles finally put away Colorado 81-77 on Sunday in the second round of the NCAA tournament. In their third season under Coach Shaka Smart, the second-seeded Golden Eagles, 27-9, reached the Sweet 16 for the first time since 2013 by outlasting the 10th-seeded Buffaloes, 26-11, and their dynamic offense. A year earlier, Marquette was also seeded number 2, but was eliminated in the second round by number 10 seed Michigan State. The Golden Eagles put that disappointment behind them by responding to every big shot by the Buffs with one of their own. We've had some adversity, Smart said, but the guys have never wavered in terms of their belief in our playing, in our way, and they stayed connected with one another, and I think that that's what won us the game today. Cam Jones scored 18 points, and Joplin finished with 14 for Marquette, which shot 61.8% from the field but still couldn't shake Colorado until the closing seconds. Chase Ross made a tie-breaking three-pointer off of a pass from Kolek with 2 minutes and 53 seconds remaining, finishing with 12 points on 5 of 6 shooting. Coach always preaches, F it, shooting. So when I got it, it was F it, and it went in, Ross said. KJ Simpson scored 20 points, and Tristan Da Silva had 17 for Colorado, which trailed by 11 at halftime, but rallied to take a 55-54 lead just over 5 minutes into the second half. Kolek put the Golden Eagles back on top with a short jumper, and Marquette never trailed again. But Colorado tried it twice, the last time on a three-pointer by Da Silva with 4 minutes and 2 seconds remaining. We had all just had the mentality of, I'm not giving up. We've done that throughout the whole year, Simpson said. That was just the mindset, that we can go out there and we can still come up back and never give up and never give up on the effort. We did just that. We just came up short. The Buffs trailed 79-77 and had to foul 3 times before putting Joplin on the line for a 1-1. He knocked down both. Playing his second game since an oblique injury that sidelined him for 6 contests, Kolek was efficient for the Golden Eagles. The nation's leader in assists at 7.8 per game, he shot 10 of 14 from the floor and routinely found open teammates. The senior scored Marquette's final basket with flair. Kolek drove the baseline and circled back into the lane before lofting a jumper over Eddie Lampkin Jr. for a 3-point edge. It was the 5th consecutive single-digit margin for the Buffaloes, who concluded their season with 6 games in 11 days, of which they won 4. Next, there is a blurb titled, Focused LSU Rallies Past MTSU. LSU coach Kim Mulkey pledged that she wouldn't let an impending Washington Post quote-unquote hit piece about her derail the defending national champion Tigers during the women's NCAA tournament. A dominant second-half surge, led by star forward Angel Reese and dynamic guard Flauje Johnson, proved Mulkey right, at least for now. Reese's 20 points and 11 rebounds and Johnson's 21 points helped third-seeded LSU pull away for an 83-56 second-round victory over number 11 seed Middle Tennessee on Sunday. Listen, man, we're not going to let one sleazy reporter distract us from what we're trying to do. Absolutely not, Mulkey said. My kids didn't even know I said that yesterday. That team is not involved in this. They were in shock when they all saw that on the internet. Mulkey grabbed headlines when she railed against the Washington Post and even threatened legal action. Reese said Sunday that she didn't know anything about that, but that other teammates did. Coach Mulkey's had our back all year, so we've got to have Coach Mulkey's back, said forward Anisha Morrow, who scored 19 points. We've got to play hard and for one another, and that is as simple as it is. LSU, playing out of the Albany Region 1, trailed by 9 in the third quarter before surging to a comfortable lead, which ended the Blue Raiders' 20-game win streak. MTSU 6'6" starting center Anastasia Boltvreva scored 9 points and blocked 3 shots, but fouled out just before the end of the third quarter. Savannah Wheeler, the Conference USA Player of the Year, scored 21, and Scott scored 15 for Middle Tennessee, which lost for the first time since December 30th. And then there is a picture that's included of LSU's Angel Reese going up for a rebound with Middle Tennessee's Jada Granum during the first half of their second round game on Sunday. And they are, like, both reaching up for the ball. You can see them kind of, like, diving in for it. Neither of them have reached the ball at that point. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, March 25th, 2024. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Brecken from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.